Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I'm thrilled to have a fabulous show for you today. I've got two amazing guests, Dr. Alia Al-Mawafi and Dr. Rachel Tobis, who are both dental anesthesiologists from Toronto, Canada. They run a really exciting course on airway emergencies. And so we're going to talk about airway emergencies in the office-based setting, something that obviously applies to any dental anesthesiologist out there, but also to anyone, anesthesiologist or otherwise, who is dealing with airways outside of the main hospital. And honestly, a lot of what we're going to talk about would apply in the hospital as well. So Dr. Al-Mawafi is a board-certified dental anesthesiologist. She takes care of all ages, but really enjoys pediatric patients. She teaches at the Faculty of Dentistry at the University of Toronto in the Dental Anesthesia Program. She's the immediate past president of the Ontario Dental Society of Anesthesiology and is passionate about safety in the office-based environment. And Dr. Rachel Tobis obtained her Doctor of Dental Surgery degree from the University of Toronto and pursued further expertise through a three-year specialty program in dental anesthesia at the same institution. She currently practices dental anesthesia in private practice and is a clinical instructor for the dental anesthesia residents at the Faculty of Dentistry at the University of Toronto. Dr. Tobis is passionate about providing dental and medical professionals with essential skills to navigate challenging scenarios, enhancing patient safety and procedural outcomes. I'm thrilled to have them both with me today. So, Alia and Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us, Jed. We're so excited to be here.
So let's
start. Thank you so much, Jed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
Well, thrilled. So let's start a little bit with, tell us a little bit about how you each got interested in this special area of kind of airway emergencies outside the hospital.
Perfect. So, you know, as you said, we're both dental anesthesiologists. A little bit of my research that I did in my master's project looked at the safety of mortality and morbidity for deep sedation and general anesthesia in Ontario. And that was a retrospective study where we looked at a 25-year period and reviewed critical incidents that had occurred. And it was so interesting to me to review those critical incidents because, you know, I got access to the Office of the Chief Coroner of Ontario, and we worked with the Royal College of Dental Surgeons. And I really became very curious about how errors occur during anesthesia. And really, patient safety became a major focus for me. So Rachel and I went to residency together. I was a senior, she was a junior. And we both shared this passion for safety and anesthesia. And the nice thing that happened when we both started to practice is we would talk to each other every day after work and we would kind of debrief on our cases. And we had a really great honesty policy about telling each other, I would have done that differently, or, you know, I wouldn't be too hard on yourself about that. And that's how we really became so curious about this area.
Fabulous. Rachel, anything to add?
Well, from these phone calls that Alia have and I, we still have almost daily after work, we wanted to then create an environment for other dental sedation providers where they're able to ask the same kinds of questions that we ask each other and to be able to practice emergency skills. Because unlike a physician anesthesiologist like yourself who's practicing in the hospital, you have your anesthesia lounge, your colleagues are right there, you guys can bounce ideas off each other. In the event of an emergency, you can call in a pal. But with dentistry, it's isolating. More often than not, we're practicing alone. So we want to help people feel more confident and more prepared when handling an unexpected event.
Fabulous. Well, I'm glad that you've taken this interest because it's such an important area. So tell me a little bit about some of the common themes that you have found that come about when things go wrong. You've had these conversations with each other and others, I'm sure, about what goes wrong and what to do about it and what you would do or what someone else did. So what are some of the common themes that come across?
So, you know, the interesting thing is that people are usually very intelligent. They are very technically skilled. They are well prepared or, you know, to do the procedure. But the majority of the time, you know, critical incidents occur not because you have, you know, a patient with a congenital heart condition that was undetected or, you know, it's not usually the black swan case. You know, more than 70% of the time, critical incidents occur due to human error. And that's the interesting part because it means that we can really improve. We can improve these outcomes if we just improve the area that we're making errors in.
And say a little bit about, just for folks who aren't familiar with kind of the lingo, when we say human error, what does that mean? Give me an example of what is a human error as opposed to any other kind.
Yeah, so human error would be, you know, we'll get a little bit more into this, but making a misdiagnosis, maybe not managing the airway as well as you could have, becoming super fixated on one aspect of the clinical picture while ignoring other aspects of or other signs and symptoms that may be pointing to something else. These are all the kind of mistakes that humans can make. You know, it's very stressful for us. And unfortunately, stress acutely degrades performance, memory, and the truth is you're not going to be at your best in a crisis. You know, the things that you do every day, for example, if you're an oral surgeon and you take out wisdom teeth, that's something that you're going to be excellent at because you've done it thousands of times. One of the things that's super challenging about office-based anesthesia is that it is remarkably safe. And the risk of something catastrophic happening is 1 in 1 million, as we know from the literature. But that safety profile is also what means that clinicians, because it happens so rarely, it also means that clinicians are probably underprepared to manage these emergencies because they simply don't encounter them frequently enough. So it's a paradox. It's incredibly safe. And we can tell our patients that, you know, you should feel confident. I tell every single one of my patients, the risk of anything catastrophic happening here is 1 in 1 million. And the other side of that is we're always prepared to manage emergencies. And the more that we practice those emergencies, the better we will be at to manage them in a confident fashion.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds exactly right. And so much, as you said, of what we potentially have to be ready for in anesthesia are things we may never see or we may see very, very rarely. And yet we have to be ready for it. So it's challenging. And I know this is part of why you all do what you do. So let's maybe look at this through some cases. So do you have a case that we could go through that would help people understand some of the common things that you see and help people understand how to deal with?
Yeah. So the two cases that we're going to present, they do come from Alia's study. So they're from Ontario, Canada. But I just want to, before I get into the cases, I want to provide some context because our discussion, it's based solely on the information that was made available to Alia and her team in the coroner's reports. So as a result, there are going to be some details that are incomplete and certain questions that we just can't be answered, that can't be answered from the available records. Also, it's important to recognize that these cases do represent some of the most challenging moments in clinical practice. And while our goal is to learn from these events and discuss opportunities on how we can improve patient safety, we also want to acknowledge that the clinicians involved were facing extremely difficult circumstances. So we're not here to judge, but we just want to try to better understand what happened and what we can learn and how we can improve for the future care of patients.
Fabulous.
The first case, it's of an 18-year-old male who has a medical history of asthma, and he presented to an oral surgeon's office to have his third molars removed under general anesthesia. The anesthetic was being provided by a physician anesthesiologist. So for airway management, the anesthesiologist intubated with a nasal endotracheal tube. And immediately following intubation, they noticed that there was high airway pressure. So when they went to bag, it was like bagging against a rock. When they went to auscultate, there was no air entry. And based on this patient having a history of asthma and based on the signs and symptoms that presented, they diagnosed and treated this as a bronchospasm. And for management of the bronchospasm, they got essentially everything under the kitchen sink. So what was listed in the report, they got Ventolin, they got epinephrine, magnesium sulfate. Just to note, we don't know how, like the route of administration, just we know this is what they used. Despite giving all these medications, the patient did continue to deteriorate. So their oxygen saturation continued to drop and they eventually went into cardiac arrest. That's when CPR was initiated and EMS was called. And the patient was transferred to the hospital with continued CPR and the endotracheal tube in place. Now, when they got to the ER, and they were continuing CPR, the tube actually dislodged and they did note that there was a kink at the end of the tube. So unfortunately, in this case, it was misdiagnosed as a bronchospasm, but in reality, this was due to a kinked tube. So the outcome for this case was the patient suffered from prolonged hypoxia. So it was a total of 27 minutes without oxygen, which ultimately led to the cardiac arrest and the hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. So what can be described here was ultimately the anesthesiologist went through what Alia was actually touching upon before, which was the fixation errors. So it's an error in which the individual and their team focuses on one aspect of the situation while ignoring more relevant information. So for our patient here, what was focused on was that they were asthmatic, but they weren't really acknowledging that they didn't improve with the medications that were administered. So I'm going to let Alia go into some more details about the errors.
Please. Yeah. It's obviously a tragic case and I'm sure it was incredibly difficult for the clinician as well as, of course, for the patient and family. So fixation error, getting focused on this one kind of most obvious potential thing, in this case, bronchospasm, but unfortunately to the exclusion of other possible causes, which in this case obviously led to a bad outcome. So Alia, take us through what else we can learn from this.
Okay, so just as you touched on, I find this case to be incredibly tragic and really hard for everyone involved. The most tragic part of it is probably that it was unavoidable. And fixation errors, you may have heard them referred to as tunnel vision. So there's different types of fixation errors. There's the one that's called this and only this, and this is what's commonly referred to as tunnel vision. So it's basically an error, a cognitive error that occurs when we focus on only one diagnosis and we ignore other aspects of the clinical picture that are contributing to it. And we're just become fixated. Like, this is bronchospasm. There's no chance that anything else is happening here. The other type of fixation error that can occur is that it's everything but this, right? So you can start to think like, oh, my patient's hypotensive and maybe tachycardic, but they're definitely not anaphylaxis. They're anaphylactic. They're just dry. So it's kind of potentially undermining the situation or not ruling out potential worst case scenarios. And the last one is everything is okay. And this is one that I actually think for those of us that practice in the office-based scenario, where typically our anesthetics are running really smoothly, we're doing elective cases, we've probably gotten into trouble a couple of times and gotten ourselves out of trouble, I think we're most at risk of making this error where we just think that everything is okay. And it's really important to acknowledge when you as a clinician are feeling out of control as a lone provider in the office-based environment. You know, there's no faulting for starting the emergency response system and then maybe stabilizing the patient by the time EMS gets there, right? The earlier you call for help, the better. And the earlier that you acknowledge help and really cue your team on to the fact that we may be in a sticky situation here, the better this patient is going to do.
Hey, folks, I just want to take a second to shout out our rockstar returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA PRA Category 1 credits after you finish training and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC. All right, and we're back. So that's really interesting. I had not thought about breaking the fixation down into those different types, but they totally make sense. So you can either be focused on one thing and not think about anything else, or you can consider a lot of things, but not one of the things, maybe the worst possible thing. And then the everything is okay. I love the everything is okay, because that's like where you're like, oh yeah, the SAT's reading low, but it's not real, right? Everything's all good. And all of those can be problematic. So how do we overcome this when it happens? Because it's easy for us to sit here and say, oh yeah, you know, I wouldn't do that. But of course, when you're stressed and the patient is desatting, it's really hard. That's why these things happen. So how do we do that? And actually, I wanted to ask you, Elliot, you said you thought this was unavoidable. Do you mean unavoidable because the clinician was not prepared for this? Or do you mean like there would have been no way to avoid this happening?
I think she meant avoidable.
I'm sorry. I meant to say that this was entirely avoidable.
Okay. Yes. Good. So that's what I thought. So this was avoidable, but only if there had been some better approach to this and better preparation. Okay, good. So I think we're on the same page.
Go ahead. We'll get into that a little bit more when we talk about these strategies. We can talk about why I think it really was so avoidable.
Okay, good. So yeah. So how do we overcome fixation errors?
So I'm going to talk about a couple strategies from the Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundation, actually, to help overcome these errors. So what they first suggest is you want to rule out the worst case scenario. So, for example, Alia brought up about the hypotension tachycardia example. So we might be like, oh, yeah, the blood pressure is low, the heart rate's high, they're probably just fasting for a long period of time. But anaphylaxis is still possible, so we need to rule that out first. Next, you want to accept that your first assumption might actually be wrong. So you should be open to other differentials and to possibly changing your differential. And this can be done with the use of checklists, which Alia is going to talk about shortly. Next, you want to consider artifacts as the last explanation. So for example, if you have a poor waveform on your oxygen saturation probe, you might think like, oh, the OR is cold. Like it's probably just reading poorly. But what if the patient really has poor perfusion as a result of hypotension, which is the result of anaphylaxis? So we can't ignore that. And then lastly, we want to make sure we don't bias our team members with a previous conclusion. So for example, in my practice, I make sure to train my team. So my nurses and my dental assistants as well, even if they have any concerns, if they have any discomforts, or even if they have an opinion on what might be going on. And don't just assume that I'm the only right one in the room, because they might have a valid point and they could be right. So,
yeah, I think that's super important. And I think that last point is really key, because I think we do that too often. You know, we call a stat, a code, whatever you want to say, and this, all these people come in and we say, okay, here's what I think is going on. And I think sometimes it is, maybe all the time, it's more helpful if you say, you know, the patient is desatting, you know, we need help, rather than the patient's desatting, we think it's a bronchospasm, and, you know, help me manage the bronchospasm, because then everyone else is going to go down the same route you just went down.
Exactly. You've just biased everybody.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So, and I'm laughing because I also remember as a brand new CA1, and we used to give 2 of Versed to everybody when I was a resident. Everybody in pre-op got 2 of Versed. And so I remember giving this old patient 2 of Versed, and then we wheeled back to the OR and we hooked the patient up to the monitors, and the SAT was like, you know, 80%. And my attending says to me, what do you think is going on with the SAT? And I said, it's not real. And he said, you sure? Because I don't think the patient's breathing, you know. And it was just like you the desire, especially as a relatively inexperienced person, to just want everything to be okay and to assume that, well, most people are okay, so it's not real. So I totally think that's important to try to back away from that. And again, the only way to do that is to be aware of it beforehand.
Absolutely.
So, Ali, do you want to talk a little bit about how checklists can help?
Yes. And this is why I said I believe this outcome could have been avoided. The use of a crisis checklist Specifically for this scenario, the use of a crisis checklist for high airway pressure would have prompted this clinician to have an evidence-based systematic approach to the emergency. And that's what these checklists are designed to do. They're designed just like pilots in aviation have checklists that they are really trained to follow. You know, pilots are trained not to use their judgment. They're trained to use the checklist. And so when we find ourselves in a situation where things are not improving, we want to be pulling out these checklists just like pilots do. They make sure that you address key interventions that, if omitted, may have serious adverse outcomes. And they're particularly useful for people like us who are lone anesthesiologists in the office-based environment, and we don't have a code blue button. Our code blue is calling 911 like every single other citizen in the city. So I like the Stanford Anesthesia Manual. There are so many crisis checklists out there. Many of them are available to download on your phones. Big shout out to Stanford Anesthesia because you can download their app for free on your phone. And I use them all the time. Even if my nurses are very used to me always having it out. And if the patient's hypotensive and I've tried everything that I can and things aren't improving, I just say, you know, pull it out. Let's make sure that we've gone through everything. So you want to pull out these manuals earlier than later. And even if you do pull it out later, you want to delegate the task to someone to make sure that they are reading through it and making sure that you have addressed all of these interventions. So if you do have a look at the Stanford Anesthesia Manual, the one for high airway pressures, I do think it would have prompted this anesthesiologist to make sure that the endotracheal tube was patent. And that could have really changed the outcome in this case. You know, the other thing too is like the patient was just intubated. And we had a professor who would always say to us whenever we did an intervention, did it make things better or worse? You know, have things gotten worse since you put that tube in there? Well, maybe it's time to take it out because you were able to oxygenate the patient prior to this. And so again, it's just going back to that idea of having mental flexibility and fluidity in these emergencies. And remembering, you know, we have another mentor of ours that always says patients don't die because of a lack of intubation. They die because of a lack of oxygenation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. Okay. Let's talk about another case.
Okay.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, ACRACers. Has your routine taken a hit these past couple of months with summer travel and all your other obligations? Well, if you're like me, you feel the need to get back to eating real food, and Factor makes that easy, even when you're on the go. Factor makes chef-crafted, dietitian-designed, ready-to-eat meals so you don't have to choose between real food and convenience. Factor meals are ready in 2 minutes and require no prep and no cleanup, so even on the days your schedule's completely out of control, eating well is still achievable. Every week you'll find over 100 nutrient-dense items to choose from and new options like salmon burgers, shredded pork, collard greens, and more, plus add-ons you'll crave like pumpkin-flavored cheesecakes and protein shakes. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. Some of our favorites right now are the shredded chicken taco bowl and the buffalo ranch burger. Let's eat real. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off and one free breakfast item per box for 1 year while supplies last until 10/31/26. That's code ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com. ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com. See website for more details. Hey folks, August is the perfect time to hit reset before the autumn rush begins, and honestly, I can't think of a better place to start than my closet. That's why I love shopping at Quince. Quince is all about fewer, better pieces. Their clothes are made with premium materials built to last and designed to become the ones you reach for day after day. They specialize in everyday staples that work harder, like their ultra-soft organic cotton tees and premium Mongolian cashmere sweaters. If you're still hanging on to the same worn-out basics, Quince makes it easy to upgrade. They have premium denim and tailored chinos from just $60 with the kind of high-quality fabrics you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. I absolutely love the new swim trunks I got from Quince. They have a comfortable inner liner, and they look great. Even my wife and daughters give them a thumbs up, and that is a rare thing. Upgrade your everyday. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/ACCRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC.
Hey folks, I wanted to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, Figs scrubs. I love my Figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all Figs all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, a medical student, a CRNA, an SRNA, or an anesthesiologist like me. Investing in a couple of pairs of Figs is totally worth it. And now back to school season is here. While that means lectures, labs, and late nights for healthcare workers in training, it's also a reminder that in medicine, education never really ends. Figs, the premium apparel brand for healthcare professionals, just dropped fresh colors and exclusive back-to-school styles. From scrubs to outerwear to footwear and beyond, Figs keeps awesome humans looking sharp, performing their best, and ready to take on anything from marathon lab sessions to 12 or even 24-hour shifts. So, if you're in healthcare or know someone who is, get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with codes FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGS, F-I-G-S-R-X.
Hey folks, this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You've heard me talk about BetterHelp for a long time, but I don't know that we've ever actually talked about how much people love this service when they use it. You can check it out yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews to see amazing customer reviews in real time. The reviews are updated every day with hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how helpful it's been to them. Please visit betterhelp.com/reviews to see for yourself. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people who have actually used the service speaks for itself. More than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally. The consistent feedback from real users makes it easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists have at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of hands-on experience. They also hold all required education, training, and certifications across a range of mental health specialties. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. That's betterhelp.com. Visit betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com.
All right, and we're back.
So this is a 9-year-old female with muscular dystrophy who presented to an oral maxillofacial surgeon for a simple extraction under deep sedation. Again, I just want to reiterate that these cases are a little bit like playing a broken game of telephone. This is the information that we have. We're sharing with you the information that we have. But, you know, if we're missing anything, we would be unaware of it, really. What happened in this case is the case was uneventful. The tooth was extracted, probably very quickly. The patient had received 50% nitrous oxide and oxygen for sedation, plus 1 milligram of midazolam and 20 milligrams of ketamine. Now, her weight was not on the incident report, but let's assume for a 9-year-old female, she was around 32 kilos, would be around the average weight. Keeping in mind that she does have muscular dystrophy, could have been smaller than that, may have been hypotonic. We don't really have that information. So after the tooth was extracted, she goes into a laryngospasm. And there were efforts made to suction and to break the laryngospasm with positive pressure ventilation, and those efforts were ineffective. So the clinician decides to give succinylcholine to break the laryngospasm, and they decide to give it through the intramuscular route. Now, we're not sure why that was the case, but they give intramuscular succinylcholine through the submentally 20 milligrams. And even though we don't have her weight, we know that that's probably a very low dose of succinylcholine for the intramuscular route, because the appropriate dose would be 4 milligrams per kilogram. And you want to give that good dose in the intramuscular route to make sure that it's going to be absorbed, because the absorption is going to be slower than in the intravenous route. So anyway, this was ineffective at breaking the laryngospasm. She has another series of laryngospasms. Similar efforts are made with positive pressure ventilation, suctioning. And in total, she gets the same management of 20 milligrams of succinylcholine given in the intramuscular route. So over time, she gets a total of 100 milligrams of succinylcholine. It was noted that multiple unsuccessful intubation attempts were made, and EMS was called. So again, even though it sounded like the medications that she had received were not really that much, it was clear that she must have been attended enough that the clinician felt that they should attempt intubation. Now, she was stabilized, and when EMS arrived, The report indicates that the clinician saw her sitting up on the gurney, and she was transferred to the ambulance. Now, the clinician stayed at the clinic because they had other surgeries for the rest of the afternoon, and they got a phone call later that day from the ER, letting them know that, unfortunately, this patient had transpired in the emergency room. The reports we have from the emergency room say that she developed respiratory distress in the ER. The emergency room, they tried to intubate her. It was unsuccessful. So they did an emergency trach, and shortly after that, she went into cardiac arrest. So, again, this is an incredibly tragic case. There are several points to review, but I think it's important to point out that the cause of death is not 100% certain, because we do have some gaps in what exactly occurred. You know, is it possible that since succinylcholine is relatively contraindicated for this patient, since she has a history of muscular dystrophy, is it possible that she went into rhabdomyolysis and had hyperkalemia and went to a hyperkalemic cardiac arrest? Maybe, although the dose was not huge that she received. I'm not sure that would have caused that. Regardless, we are unsure if that was communicated to the ER team. And let's say that you weren't prepared with rocuronium, although that would be, or sesetricurium or another muscle relaxant that would be appropriate for a patient with muscular dystrophy. If she had received succinylcholine, it would have been important to communicate that to the ER team so that they could take labs, measure her lights, make sure that her potassium was within normal limits. Now, the other piece here is that we know that multiple attempts were made at intubation. And we know that multiple attempts at intubation leads to airway edema. Now, the errors that occurred in this case is really, I think it goes back to the classic of what we're taught in the office-based environment, is that patient selection is the most important thing that we do here. I always tell my patients, you know, we're happy to see you here if it's safe to see you here, but people that need to be seen in the hospital that may need extra resources really should be seen in the hospital. So I don't think that this patient was appropriate for the office-based setting. Additionally, I know that because there wasn't enough workup done on this patient. And after the case, after she had passed away, they did some look into her medical history, and she did have significant respiratory compromise from the muscular dystrophy. So that may be why these, you know, doses of medications that seem fairly small may have actually affected her so significantly. The second piece is that, you know, it's really important to have an appropriate anesthetic plan. So I have seen patients with muscular dystrophy in the dental office, and some of them have been wheelchair bound, and they actually have come with a tag that's attached to their wheelchair that says, for a dental appointment, it's safe for me to receive nitrous oxide sedation. And that's usually what I would stick to for them if they have, you know, mild muscular dystrophy. But if they have significant respiratory compromise, I really do think it's more appropriate for them to be seen in the hospital-based setting.
And is that, now, let me ask you guys, because you're the experts on this. Is it hard? I mean, if a neurosurgeon, let's say, you know, says to you, you work in their office, and they say, you know, here, we've got this person coming, I need your help. Is it just like culturally kind of hard to say, no, I'm not going to do that? I mean, I know it's important to be able to say that, but is there, especially on like a new dental anesthesiologist, or no, is it pretty accepted? Like you say no, they're happy with that. They want you to say no when it's inappropriate.
I think it's very accepted. I think Rachel and I are really lucky. The oral surgeons that we work with, you know, they give us autonomy over our anesthetics, and they are incredibly respectful of our opinions. And some of the surgeons we work with, they actually have us triage their patients and say, like, who do you think should go to the hospital? Who can we see here? Who maybe should I do with local just by myself here when you're not here, you know? So they're really incredible that way. And our opinions are respected for sure.
Great. Okay. So that's hopefully not an issue. Obviously, we can't speak for all oral surgeons or all anesthesiologists. Okay. So great. So what do you think would have helped to have a different outcome in this case?
I think one of the big things that I would take away from this is the multiple attempts at intubation. For myself, I have a rule that really, in the middle of an emergency, if I am attempting intubation, I want to temporize, you know, my role in the pre-hospital setting, if I have initiated an EMS call, is to temporize this patient, to get them to the hospital until they can receive the interventions that they require. So I don't need to be a hero. I don't need to do everything in the office-based environment. I want to get to the hospital where we can have more help. And so, you know, I really like the KISS principle, like keep things as simple as possible. If I can improve oxygenation with a more simple device, like a supraglottic airway, I'm going to be leaning to do that and transfer the patient with that in place. Now, I have a rule for myself that really, you know, I want to make probably 2 attempts at intubation, and try to leave 1 last good attempt for the hospital. But you know, that's keeping in mind that I'm able to oxygenate the patient in other ways, whether it's bag mass ventilation or with a supraglottic airway. And the other parts, and obviously if that's not happening, it's being honest about the fact that we're getting to a point of can't intubate and can't ventilate, and it's time to get the front of neck access kit out, and be prepared for that. The things I would have done differently is I may have given her an anticholinergic. It sounds like maybe she was really wet from the ketamine. I may have given her an anticholinergic to dry her out a little bit. I would have given a bigger dose of succinylcholine, 4 mg/kg in the IM route, but I would have chosen the intravenous route. And would have given a good dose of sux, 1 mg/kg, 1 to 2 mg/kg in the intravenous route that I think may have been better. You know, this is one of those situations, and Rachel and I often talk about this, about sometimes when you're being too cautious and you're not giving enough to really treat the problem, you're not getting through it. You're not getting to the next stage. And so you have to really confidently give the right dose of medication to be able to break this laryngospasm. And unfortunately, I think that that's the major issue that happened here.
Yeah, Rachel.
One thing, or just something else I would have added in, I would have gone with the patient to the ER to let them know what I had given for my anesthetic, what I did to manage the situation. So letting them know this is a patient with muscular dystrophy, they got succinylcholine. How many attempts at intubation did I make? So that way they have all that information there, and they're not playing a guessing game. So they had known I made X number of attempts. Oh, perhaps there's significant airway edema. Perhaps we have to go right to a FONA or something. And maybe we have to run her labs and make sure there isn't any hyperkalemia occurring. So just something else.
Yeah. And I mean, I imagine it's incredibly rare to have to do front of neck access in a dental office, but when you have to do it, you have to know how to do it. Right. And you can't call your ENT surgeon who's in the OR next door. So it's you. And this is a great example, I think, of one of the things you need to practice, because if you got to do it, you got to do it. And do you all, when you do anesthesia, do you have, what do you have in terms of front of neck access? Do you have a perc trach kit? Do you have a bougie and a scalpel? Like what is the go-to?
Scalpel. Yeah, I think, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's the scalpel and bougie technique.
Yeah, yeah, I have the
scalpel,
same
finger
thing.
Bougie. Yeah.
I have the same thing, but different offices would have different setups. Some people would use the quick trach kit, and you have to have a quick kit in Ontario in order to administer a deep sedation or a general anesthesia. So everyone would probably have what they're most comfortable with. And I think for Rachel and I, we've just become most comfortable with the bougie and scalpel technique.
So what's your algorithm? You've got a patient you can't ventilate in the office setting. So, and this is probably not any different than in the OR, but what do you do? Kind of take us through your steps. 1, 2, 3. What do you go through? You've induced a patient. Now you can't ventilate. What are you going to do?
Yeah. So I think first things I would go back to, going back to basics, right? Making sure you've optimized airway positioning, make sure you the patient's in a good position, jaw thrusting them, putting in an oral airway. If I'm unable to bag them at that point, I'm moving to a two-person bag mask ventilation. We usually have nasal prongs on for our inductions. That's usually how we pre-oxygenate patients. And the nice thing about nasal prongs is that when the patient's apneic and you are having trouble ventilating, they can also be a second source of passive oxygenation. So sometimes I will just turn up the nasal prongs to 10 to 15 liters per minute and close the patient's mouth and jaw thrust them and see if I can get some passive oxygenation that way while I am still preparing to make my next interventions. If I'm still not able to bag the patient, I'm going to be moving to a supraglottic airway. For the emergency base, for the office-based setting for emergencies, I like to use eye gels because they're simple. You don't need to inflate them. They're just a quick insertion. And if eye gels don't work, then I'm moving to potentially King Airway. If I think that this patient is a complicated intubation or a difficult intubation, I may still be trying my supraglottic airways. And if I think I'd be able to intubate them without challenge, I'm going to move to make an attempted intubation next. I would use a video laryngoscope for that intubation because I know I'm already in a sticky situation, and my video laryngoscopes are going to increase the likelihood of this intubation going well. The other thing about them is that they just give you such a great view of the airway. So you're able to see if there's anything else potentially contributing to airway obstruction, like a foreign body being in the airway as well.
Yeah, great. And go ahead. Sorry. No, please.
No, and lastly, we've already touched on it, but if you get to this point, right, you may have to do front of neck access. No one's excited about it, but it's something that you have to do if you need to. And if you are unable, we don't usually encourage clinicians to paralyze in the office-based setting. You know, we really want to maintain patients' ability to spontaneously ventilate. But if you've gotten to this point, you've made attempts at intubation, you still cannot intubate and cannot ventilate, and if you have not paralyzed to this point, it's probably a good time to paralyze to optimize the conditions for the front of neck access.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great algorithm that applies anywhere, right? I mean, that's really what you should be doing. Rachel, were you on asthma?
Oh, just when we're getting to phono, we're calling 911 at that point.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. That's a difference. We're not calling 911, but it seems like a good idea at that point.
Instead of the code blue button, 911's coming.
So let's talk about, as you looked through the closed claims, what are some themes that came up that you think are helpful for people to know?
So, you know, I think we touched on this before, but 70% of anesthesia errors are attributable to human factors. It's not deficits in medical knowledge or technical skill. The rarity of these critical events is a primary driver for poor crisis performance. Fixation error is the most well-documented cognitive failure. So really, you know, having mental flexibility is really important, and reminding yourself of that and listening to other people in the room and allowing other people in the room to have voices that they feel comfortable using is really important. Stress makes everything worse. It makes a terrible situation a lot worse. It's going to degrade your working memory, prospective memory, and analytical decision-making. So the more that, you know, sometimes I think athletes talk about being in this like flow-like state when they're playing really well. And that's the kind of state we would like to be in when we're managing these crises. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is if we practice them on a frequent basis in simulation.
Yeah.
Because that's so important. We really are going to build confidence.
Yeah.
And the last thing is that the office-based setting makes things challenging. It has inherent risks through isolation and absent backup sources. So for any clinician practicing in that environment, it's just always important to be thoughtful about that.
Great. Let's talk about the airways. Like how can people who maybe aren't doing this stuff all the time or just who want to make sure they have the key skills for when things go really bad, how can they build and maintain those airway skills?
Well, the best thing is find a simulation course, go to CE, practice, go to university, work on cadavers, like your local university. I'm sure you can go in and practice on them. Because in reality, we thankfully don't come across these situations to use them frequently and maintain that skill. There, I would say majority of dental sedation providers can go years or months or years without performing an advanced airway intervention like intubation or LMA insertion. And deliberate hands-on practice and simulation is essential really to maintain that competence. So there was an interesting literature review that was published in the American Academy of Nurse Anesthesiologists journal in 2024. And they confirmed this consensus across multiple studies that with longer non-practice intervals, it's associated with progressively greater performance loss. So for intubations, the skills began to decline within 3 to 4 months of non-use. And then by 6 months, there was measurable performance loss. So the longer interval of not using these skills, the progressively worse your performance was. And what the most interesting thing about this study is that your years of experience does not prevent decay. So you could be an anesthesiologist who's practicing 20, 30 years, but if you haven't intubated in the last 6 months, you can have measurable performance loss. So just to reiterate, practice, 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 whether it's coming to our Navigating Airway Challenges course, or any other airway course, or like I said, going to your local university's cadaver lab, just practice, run sims with your team in your office. Like, it's so, so important. Just like we do for PALS and ACLS.
Absolutely. That's a great example, right? People do that every year, every 2 years. And if you're, it's one thing if you're intubating and putting LMAs in every day, but if you're not, then getting that practice is probably more important, honestly, than ACLS. So you talk about your course is fabulous, and it is, how often is it offered? We will put a link to your website on the in the show notes so people can check it out there, but how often do you offer it, and when's the next one?
We run our course once to twice a year in Toronto, Canada. The next one is coming up October 3rd and 4th, 2026. You know, everything we've talked about is why we started this course. It's because these skills are really like a language. If you don't use it, you lose it. And we really try to encourage an environment where we don't want anyone to be perfect. We want you to make mistakes. We want to talk about those mistakes because that's really how you learn. And when you come to the course, we do a review in the morning, didactic review. It's ourselves and our team, some amazing dental anesthesiologist. We have an ENT physician on board who teaches the Crike station, the front of neck access station, because they're definitely the experts in this area. And the afternoon is a rotation through these stations. So you get high fidelity simulation. You'll do one case with an adult, one case with a pediatric patient. All the cases are real cases. We're not making up these cases. These are real incidents where things went wrong, and you get an opportunity to see how you would manage it. After the cases, everyone debriefs with the team, and we talk about what could have been done better, what are the points to learn from. There are two airway rooms, an adult airway room and a pediatric airway room. And that's really where we get to play with all these different toloids, video laryngoscopes, different supraglottic airways, different types of bougies. And that's where we get to have some fun together. And then lastly, we have the front of neck access station, where you get to do front of neck access on pig tracheas. It's been a ton of fun. We've had so much fun doing this. We've had such great feedback. And we know there's been a gap in the continuing education space for office-based providers, for dental providers. So that's really why we wanted to start this. And it's definitely a passion project for us. We enjoy it so much. And we hope to see if anyone, you know, if you feel this has spoken to you in any way, we really hope to see you there.
Fabulous. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so important, and you guys obviously are passionate about it. I'm glad you're doing it. So check out the course. Go to the website. You may be hearing this after this current October of 2026, in which case go to the website and you'll see future dates. All right. Anything you guys want to say before we move on?
So just to close, thankfully, emergencies in the dental office are rare, but this is why it demands practice responses. So while catastrophic airway events in dentistry are uncommon, preparedness cannot depend on chance, and confidence will come from your regular deliberate practice, repeated simulation, and building systems that help clinicians perform effectively when seconds matter.
Couldn't agree more. Fabulous. All right, let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Rachel, let's start with you. Do you have something you'd recommend the audience check out for fun?
Well, my third passion, aside from my family, of course, they come first, and dental anesthesia, is one of my favorite bands in the whole world. Their name is Phish. They come from Vermont, and it's with a PH, because I've had some people search them on Spotify as the normal way you spell it. No, it's P-H-I-S-H. I love them. They're an improv jam band. I totally recommend going to one of their concerts, even if you never listen to them. It's not just about the music. It's a whole experience. They've never played the same set list, and they've been together for over 40 years. The crowd is amazing. You'll make 500 friends in one night. And yeah, I absolutely love them. So yeah.
Awesome. I was talking to somebody recently who is like just a huge Phish fan and has been to like, I don't know, 20 or 30 Phish concerts and was raving about them. But yeah, it's they're a very, very obviously well regarded band. Good. That's a great recommendation. Alia, how about you?
Yeah. I just want to say I've been hearing about Phish since I met Rachel, and I am yet to make it to a show with her, but I will have to do that one day. If anyone has been melting like I've been in this weather, I want to recommend a recipe, which is watermelon and tomato gazpacho. And it is such a fresh, delicious, cold soup. It comes from Spain. I used to have it in the summers in Spain, and I just recently remembered it. I saw it at a restaurant, and then Food and Wine has an incredible recipe that you should definitely try.
Awesome. I have made that and I do love it as well. And this is such fabulous tomato season. My wife grows heirloom tomatoes and they're amazing. Actually, I'm going to call out and shout out a recipe as well, which is not, I don't have like a written recipe because it's so simple, but it is, I take these fresh heirloom tomatoes and slice them and then put a slice of peach on top of that and then mozzarella cheese and basil. So it's like a caprese salad, but add the peach. And if you've got really good tomatoes, it is. And then you drizzle some olive oil and balsamic vinegar on top. And it's just amazing. Even my 8-year-old, and she's a picky eater, but my 13-year-old's even a pickier eater. And they were just downing them last night. So highly recommend, if you can get your hands on some good peaches and some good heirloom tomatoes, it is worth doing. Well, thank you both. This has been fabulous. And I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about the great work you're doing. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Jed. We really appreciate you having us.
Thank you so much for having us. And if you don't mind, I just want to give a shout out to Dr. Derek Duclos, who introduced us to ACRAC.
Yes.
So he's a fellow dental anesthesiologist and dear friend. And we're so excited that he introduced us to this podcast years ago. And I'm really happy we got to be here today.
Fabulous. Well, thanks, Derek. And thank you both. All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac.
or looking up Jay Walpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew.
Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Chidima Ikanti, Rachel Furman, and Mohamed Seleb are our production assistants and social media managers.
Thanks so much for all you do.
Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued. Thank you.